The fight is on between the House and Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. They're fighting about legislation to allow the VA secretary to fire senior executives at the agency. They're fighting about how to respond to the health care scandal and a lot more. But the Veterans Affairs Committees in both chambers are missing something that might help them better understand the problems veterans face. David Hawkins is senior editor at Roll Call. He writes the Hawkins Here blog at rollcall.com, and he's working on his latest work about the Department of Veterans Affairs and the oversight committees in each chamber. What are they missing, David, that might help them better understand what's going on at that agency?
Well, that would be veterans. That would be members of Congress who were actually veterans. So there are 39 House members and senators on the Veterans Affairs Committees, and only 8 of them ever served in uniform. And none of those 8 is either a ranking member or one of the chairmen. Now, that might seem maybe that's a statistical anomaly, and we shouldn't worry about it, or one shouldn't even be mentioning it on the radio. But as it turns out, 8 out of 39 is essentially 19%, and that is exactly the same as the share of veterans in the entire Congress. Just 19% of the current membership, 86 House members, 18 senators, was a military veteran. And that is down. It keeps going down. In the mid-1970s, when the people who fought in World War II were at the peak of their careers, three-quarters of the members of Congress were veterans. So it's gone from three-quarters to one-fifth in 30 years.
And, you know, it may be hyperbole, but the Pentagon says all the time, because of the all-volunteer force, only about 1% of Americans serve in the military right now.
That's right.
And so the proportion in Congress is far higher than the population in general. So while the numbers that you're talking about, I think, are surprising, in context, they're I shouldn't be as surprised as I am about them.
No, I think that is a great point. So right, the all volunteer army, 1973, I believe. So that's sort of essentially somebody who was turning 18 in 1973 would be in their late 50s now, early 60s. Right. So it's definitely the meat of the membership of Congress now. But it is still the case, just as after World War II, actually the first World War, the other thing that's happening right now is that the World War II generation in Congress is coming to an end. Just last week, the 91-year-old Ralph Hall from Texas, who's one of only 2 remaining World War II veterans in Congress, was defeated for renomination, defeated in the Republican primary. He and John Dingell will now be leaving at the end of the year, and that'll be the end of the line for the World War II veterans. There were some 500 of them who came to Congress. Proportionately, the number of Iraq and Afghanistan vets is about the same. I don't know. It's much smaller, but they're I think, about 18 people who served during Iraq or Afghanistan who are in the Congress now. Only one combat veteran, who's actually the newest senator, John Walsh of Montana. So I was just thinking about this. That maybe proportionately, just as the greatest generation during World War II, millions of people, whereas right now it's a tiny force by comparison. So maybe proportionately, they're still higher than average.
You'd either do some of the best research in Washington, have the greatest mind of anybody in town, or have terrific help, because you put stuff in, like this story here. The first of their ilk, referring to the World War II veterans, and you cite Congressman Hall, defeated for re-election, and Senator Lautenberg, the last World War II veteran in the Senate, passed away last year. You write, the first of their ilk arrived in 1944 when Democrat George Andrews won an Alabama House seat while on active duty in the Navy, and Republican William Jenner was appointed to fill a Senate vacancy fresh from his discharge as a captain in the Army Air Corps. That is terrific. Background information. I have to ask you, though,
because good books, research books.
Well, whatever you got, what you need, and I can commend you on that. But you write about something in this piece, which you'll have up later today, I imagine, that I couldn't figure out over the weekend. One of my friends on the Federal News Countdown last Friday cited this story about Senator Burr, Richard Burr from North Carolina, the ranking member of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, writing this open letter to the veteran service organizations, in which he didn't just touch on the third rail of veterans. He I mean, I don't know how close you could call this to self-immolation, but it seemed like he just went way overboard in criticizing all of the veteran service organizations except the American Legion for not calling for the resignation of Secretary Shinseki any sooner than they did. I'm not asking you to explain what was he thinking, but I guess what I could ask you is, does anybody that you know of that's covering the Hill have any kind of information that might indicate what he was thinking? Because that just struck me as a really bad idea.
Well, I think that what I tried to allude at in the post, which is now online and you're welcome to go read it at rollcall.com, is that Senator Burr and the veterans groups have been having sort of a simmering feud that goes back to this winter, which was when the Senate actually started debating a Democratic bill to improve veterans health care, in part by authorizing the construction of 27 additional clinics. And Senator Burr led the opposition to this bill. It was then killed it with a filibuster, and the veterans groups were furious that Senator Burr had sided with Republican orthodoxy, which was that this would cost too much and wouldn't be properly paid for, and that the Republicans were being denied their full amendment rights, which is one of the Republicans' biggest complaints in the Senate. So he, Burr, contributed to this filibuster, helped orchestrate this filibuster, and the veterans groups felt like, how dare he, since it's given the position he has, and this was sort of the start of what then bubbled over on Memorial Day weekend.
What can we learn from this about what may happen? I'm not asking you to predict the outcome politically of the VA scandal itself, but as far as the interaction between the groups that the committees have to work with and with each other, any sense of what this might mean for that? Because it doesn't look like they're headed down similar paths for anything right now.
No, it doesn't, right? The House is House Republicans are pursuing this notion of sort of more partial privatization of the VA, give veterans who have to wait a long time for appointments vouchers that they can spend, government vouchers that they can spend at private clinics. Democrats don't seem interested in that. Democrats, I think the only place that they might come together, there is a glimmer of hope that the Senate and the House are going to come together on the on language that would allow quicker dismissal of senior officials at the VA so long as there's some due process. I think both sides are under pressure now. This has now become a rare thing, which is a veterans issue that has become front page news in an election year. So there's going to be considerable pressure on both sides to compromise. As you and I know from talking every week, I tend to be more optimistic than maybe I should be, so I'll predict once again that they'll get something done between now and the election.
But that's why we talk every week, because you're optimistic instead of leaving me with a downer all the time, David.
Well, I'm glad I'm good for something.
Well, you're good for a lot more than that. David Hawkins, senior editor at Roll Call, and his Hawkins Here blog is linked now through federalnewsradio.com/in-depth.